Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. A new World Bank report says empowering women is smart economics. The argument is that greater gender equality can enhance productivity and improve development outcomes for the next generation. A little later, we'll hear about the challenges of changing the gender gap from two women working toward this goal. But first, joining us from the World Bank studio to discuss the findings of this report is the president of the World Bank, Robert Zoellick. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Diane.
Give us an overview of this report, if you would.
Well, I think what's most striking about it is a sense of how, at a time that countries around the world are struggling with economic conditions and they're looking for foundations of growth, that they've got 50% of their population that could be contributing a lot more and benefiting a lot more from a different set of policies. So in some countries, it's having the rules so women can own property or get credit. In others, it's a more complicated question of making sure that people have equal access to professions. But the striking aspect is that while progress has been made in areas such as education and health, proper investments and proper adjustments in policy offer huge potential for the individuals involved and for their societies.
So when you talk about gender equality, talk about just what you mean.
Well, the idea here is basically it starts out with the World Bank, since we deal primarily with developing countries, but we looked at developed countries too, is basic fairness, treating people the same, giving them the same opportunities, so the same chance to go to school, the same chance to move to higher levels of education, the same chance to move into jobs. But part of the of understanding gender and development is also recognizing some of the differences. So, for example, we've identified that compared to women in developed countries or to men in developing countries, the world loses about 4 million girls and young women each year. Well, what does that mean to lose? Well, what it means is that about 40% of those girls are never born. Another third are lost in the childbearing years, and the rest are lost as young girls. And so here, particular policies that might be focused, for example, on health and sanitation and some of the childbirth issues need to be directed towards women, but the stakes are the same as losing a Los Angeles or a Johannesburg every year.
I was fascinated to look at the earnings gaps between women and men. For example, in Sri Lanka, women make 50 cents on the dollar. In Bangladesh, 12 cents on the dollar.
Yeah, and this obviously depends on a whole series of potential policies. So, for example, in some developing countries, women don't have the same ability to own property. It might be legal. It might be informal. For example, in Ethiopia, we put in with the government a simple change on the property titles that allowed one to put two names. And so by allowing one to have two names, you had women as well as men, and that opened the whole door to being able to borrow credit and have different aspects of ownership. So that is the case in some countries. In other countries, it's more subtle. So you see that, for example, the numbers in Germany are much less. And I think what I've been able to see is this reflects the fact that women tend to go into certain professions and job categories. They tend to be lower earning. Now, how much of that is choice? How much of that is structure? How much is the fact that people might be discouraged to go into, say, engineering professions or lack mentors in those professions? So the interesting thing about this is that I think there's some good lessons for developed as well as developing countries.
Are you saying that if a woman is educated, say, into the law, that she will earn the same amount as a man? Or are you saying it just won't happen?
Well, I think it varies by country. I mean, we've seen this in the United States, for example.
Certainly.
What I saw, even in the time I was growing up, is I fortunately came into a period where some of the first women pioneers had gotten through a generation of law school, but they were tended to be pushed into different types of legal work that wasn't the mainstream. I think a lot of that has changed over the time for the better. So it also, I think, will vary in terms of what support you provide. So one of the other sort of points here is, say, in developing countries, having access to available water, electricity, lowers the time demands that women have at home with their families, and that allows them to take on other jobs. But there's another side, too, that I think people can recognize. For example, we now have studies that show that, and this came out of Brazil in particular, that for social safety net programs, if the money is given to the woman heads of household, that child mortality is vastly reduced, you get benefits in education. So this is recognizing there may be differences in terms of how men and women approach their family and their children. And because of that, some of developing countries are now structuring their programs to make sure the money goes to the woman head of household.
And what happens if the money goes to the men?
Well, in general, in the developing countries, you don't see quite as much invested in the children. You don't see quite as much invested in the community. And so, in particular, if you're focused on those aspects of early stage of development, you'll want to direct the funding towards the women. And that has worked quite well, actually, in Mexico and Brazil. And it's now spread to some 40 other countries in one form or another.
So as I understand it, if men get the money, it's quite likely that that will be spent on something to benefit the men. But if it's given to the women, women will somehow work with it to improve the family.
Well, you always have to be careful about generalizations, Diane. And obviously, you know, what we're doing is we're looking at overall surveys.
Sure.
So and you know, you have, for example, with the problem of child soldiers, you have some particular issues with young boys. So gender needs to look equally at the challenges of both sexes. You're now seeing in some countries that boys are not getting educated to the same degree that young girls are, but that still doesn't mean that the young girls who are educated can get into the workforce.
Mr. Zelik, I want to go back to this whole issue of women going missing in developing countries. And I'm curious as to exactly why this happens.
Well, some are never born because of gender preferences, and so that's, I think, one of the saddest stories, and you see that with the demographic numbers in some countries. Another set are basically lost early in childhood because of the particular diseases or care, or perhaps they don't rank as high when a family is dealing with limited food supplies and they suffer malnutrition. There are different diseases. And then about a third are lost in the child-rearing years. And this is, again, for developing countries, a signal of if you provide some of the support for childbearing, postnatal support, prenatal support, you can save lives and have healthier children.
And what about HIV/AIDS?
I don't recall the particular sort of sex effects of HIV/AIDS in Africa. That's just been, I think, devastating for both sexes.
Losses, as I saw, were rather great in sub-Saharan Africa for girls, especially those hit by HIV/AIDS. What is this report proposing, Mr. Zelik, in order to lessen the disparity between the genders?
Well, the first benefit is, I think, is just to get this information out and for people to see in developing and developed countries that this is not only a question, as you mentioned, of basic fairness and right, but it's a question of smart economics and looking across different developing countries and seeing the benefits that people are foregoing as well as the lack of individual opportunity. But then we talk about particular areas, for example, human capital interventions. So what can be done with sanitation, water, some of the basic health areas? What can be done in educational investments? But then another area is how you help women reach their full potential, improve their productivity, improve their effectiveness and efficiency. Then there are issues that become a little bit more complicated in terms of women's voice. So I mentioned the example of giving women a greater voice in communities in terms of having the resources of these safety net programs. But obviously, there's questions of political voice, ability to contribute. And what the surveys have shown is women parliamentarians, legislatures might have, as a general matter, a slightly different focus on some of the issues of concern. And then finally, obviously, since you're looking at this over the longer term, is how to prevent over generations, these forms of discrimination, either direct or subtle, from perpetuating themselves.
Do you believe that this report, which is not the first that the World Bank has published on gender, will make a difference?
Well, I certainly hope so. And the initial reaction that we've got, when we do these reports, we do a big report like this every year. So we talk an awful lot to parties before we prepare it. And at least the interest across a broad range of developed and developing countries is very strong.
All right. Short break. We'll be right back. And back to you, Robert Zoellick, president of the World Bank. One last question for you. What do you believe the World Bank can do to change what's happening to women, their working lives, the fairness delivered to them on a micro level in the communities, in the tribes, in the villages?
Well, over the past 5 years, we've devoted some $65 billion to projects that have integrated gender components. But I think this report can be a lesson for us, too. I think there's a lot more that we can learn from this process and from stimulating the debate. And I think the challenge for us as a large institution, you know, dealing with 187 different countries, is how do you mainstream this in a way that doesn't just become a check in the box? How do you make sure that when people are designing projects that they're understanding some of the gender elements? And one of the points, you know, going back to one of your earlier questions was, I suspect some listeners may wonder, well, is, you know, are all societies, different cultures, different religions, how do they react to some of these things? And I visited a lot of these projects. I remember one in India and Rajasthan, a very, very poor state. It was a project that was community development with women who were having some milk cows and increasing the fat production and being able to market the milk. And what I saw in terms of not only the added income, But what it did for the women in the community, starting to affect, for example, their wanting to say things about the schools and the quality of the schools, has these ripple effects that you just can't fully quantify but are very important. But equally, I went to some of the men in the village and I asked them, you know, how they felt about this. And what I found, whether it's Afghanistan, India, places in East Asia, Africa, is very encouraging, which is that when you can see people start to increase their family income by 50% or 100% or 200%, everybody likes the idea. And at a time when, you know, the world is looking for additional sources of growth, this is the next emerging market.
You know, we've had a message posted on Facebook from Ruth, who says, empower women in other countries around the globe. I suggest first pass the ERA in the USA. To what extent do you believe, Mr. Zelick, that passing the ERA here in the USA might send a signal to other countries around the world?
Well, Diane, in my job, I stay away from the domestic political debates, but let me just explain it this way. I think, you know, as an executive in an organization, people have a responsibility to practice what they preach. And over half the officers, so it's about 50 people at the World Bank Group, are now women. And that's a higher number than we have for some of the lower level managers. And what I've seen is these changes don't just happen. You actually have to work at it. You have to do it when you're doing your outreach and putting together the short lists of different people. And so I think all of us have a responsibility, whether it's legal or not, to try to, frankly, engage in smart economics as well as do what's right.
And engaging in smart economics could help the impact of the global recession. How do you see what's happening in Greece and the other countries around the world, Mr. Zelick?
That's a big question, Diane.
But
let me just say, I think this is at a very serious point. I referred to a new danger zone for the Eurozone in particular. And so far, the European actions have provided liquidity or financing so as to make sure that the Greeks can sell their bonds or the banks can have access to various resources. But these are fundamentally stopgap measures. So what you're facing now in Europe are some very fundamental decisions like those that were faced in 1989-90 when you finally ended the Cold War about how Europe will act as a region. Will they have a fiscal union that will match the monetary union? If so, with what disciplines, what form? Or if they don't, frankly, how are they going to manage the consequences of some countries that have very high debts and competitiveness problems? But I frankly think the U.S. is facing some of these issues, too. So bringing right back to the gender report, one of the aspects about this that is so powerful is at a time you're looking for sources of growth, you know, just look out the window.
Robert Zelick, president of the World Bank, former deputy secretary in the U.S. Department of State. Thank you so much for joining us, sir.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you. And joining me in the studio now to talk about the challenges of changing the gender gap, to women who are working toward this goal, Kakenya Nataya of the Kakenya Center for Excellence, and Ritu Sharma of Women Thrive Worldwide. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning. Good morning.
Tell me, Ritu, your own response, your own feelings about what you heard from President Zelick.
I think it's great the World Bank did this report. They essentially did the same report about 10 years ago in gendering development. And it's wonderful to have the World Bank's bully pulpit on this issue. The World Bank saying that equality for women is a good thing. It's good economics. I think, however, there is a danger in oversimplifying this issue to just economics. I've traveled all over the world and spent many, many hours working alongside women on farms, speaking with women in villages, really listening to their priorities. And the two things that I hear most about that are preventing them from contributing more is that they barely have time to sleep. Women are working 17 or 18 hours a day. So to think that somehow women have a quote-unquote untapped potential, that they are waiting to be tapped, I think is somewhat dangerous. Now, to be fair, the report does talk about women's time burdens, but it doesn't go into enough depth at really addressing that issue. And I think what we run the risk of is giving women, quote unquote, giving women more opportunities when what they really need is just more time.
Nataya, what is Kakinya? Nataya, what is your own thinking about this new report and the comments of Mr. Zelik?
I think for the World Bank to put out a report like this, it's a great thing. It raises the issues that many, many people have been addressing for many years. And I think for me, it's always that we need to go beyond just the abstract and talk about the theory and talk about its economic empowerment. But to me, what does that mean to a local woman in my own village who has no access to a credit, who has no right to property? What we run, there are so many. I look at issues that I deal with, like female genital cutting, that in my community is something that hinders women. And it's against the law in Kenya, but it's still being practiced.
Why?
It's because one is that those people who are supposed to implement the law, they are men who are in the villages who already uphold what the cultural rights are. And so for them, instead of supporting the women, it's literally a barrier because the women, the person who is supposed to implement the law is supporting FGM, for example, or he's supporting women should not go to school. So how does that person give the women the right? Mm-hmm. So it's really, we talk about it in theory, but to me, it's always going back to really empowering women from the rural place.
Kakinya, Nataya, and I know that you grew up in a small village in Kenya. You're the firstborn of eight. Your father was a policeman working in a distant city. At age five, they announced your engagement to a six-year-old neighbor. Tell me about your life growing up in Kenya.
As you said, I was betrothed. I was engaged when I was 5 years old and was supposed to be married when I reached puberty. Everything I did growing up was to prepare me to be that respectful woman for that young man, collecting firewood, water from the river, and, caring for my younger siblings. And everything I did literally just prepared me to be a woman. But one thing that I really looked at the life my mother was living. It was a very hard life. My father had a job. He stayed in the city, never came home. He came once a year. We didn't see him for many times. And when he came home, it was even harder for my mom because he would beat him. He would sell the cows that we had or the maize we had planted, and he would go and drink with his friends. And my mom, because she doesn't own anything, she couldn't question him. And that, looking at that life, and really I didn't admire being, ending in the state that my mom will be. And so, but the thing also about my mom was that, she always told us that she never wanted us to live the life she didn't want us to grow up to be like her. And it's something so painful because every mother wants their daughters to grow up to be like them. But the life she was living was very hard. But I managed to negotiate with people in the community.
How? What did you do?
When I was 12 years old, I was supposed to undergo female genital cutting. And to me, I wanted to go to school. But to us, is that when you undergo through this right to womanhood, you get married. So I wanted to avoid it. And I managed to talk to my father that if he was not going to let me go back to school, I was going to run away. And to me, running away, he would stay with the stigma that you have a daughter who is uncut, and so that the stigma becomes on his side. So I negotiated that I would go through the cutting if he lets me go to school. And so he did agree, and I did go back to high school. And I finished high school. I had found somebody who was in this country and wanted to come to school in the U.S. And it was something like unmeet, because no girl in my village has ever left the village to go to like the city, live around leaving a country. And when the news came that a girl is going to America to study, it was like chaos in the entire village. Everybody was against it. Nobody, you know, this chance should be given to a boy. But I managed to, again, go to the elders in a more respectful way and ask them for their support, to support me to come and get my education so that I can support them. And so that's how I managed to be.
Story. Kakenya Nataya of the Kakenya Center for Excellence. Also here, Ritu Sharma of Women Thrive Worldwide. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Ritu, I'm sure you've heard many stories like this.
Sadly, I have. And I think, as Kenya knows, most of the girls in the village are still living in the same way as her mother, which is, I think, what motivates us both to do this work. And she's really put her finger on the reality for most women, which is that violence is what really fundamentally keeps them down.
Control.
It is what forces them to do what the man says. It is what forces them to stay. It is what forces them to make choices that are not in their own self-interest or in their own economic sense. I think this report looks at women as rational economic agents. I would love to be called a rational woman, but that's yet to happen. I think that women...
But you are a rational woman operating in an irrational system.
You are, exactly. And for most women, they can't. If you are afraid you're going to be beaten, it's very hard to make good decisions.
And if you are afraid you're going to be cut, as I presume your mother was, and you were, you had to bargain your way out of it, Kenya.
Exactly. And for me, I didn't even know it is against the law, actually, because I was in the village. I didn't get any education about the things. I didn't know I had the right to go to school. And so it's just, you know. But when I came to this country and went to college and found out that it was against the law to practice female genital cutting, it's actually the right, I had the right to go to school, that my mother was not supposed to be beaten, and that she has the right to own a property. And to me, I was just amazed.
Need to know how you came to this country.
As I said, I got a scholarship to go to a university here, and through that I...
But how did you even make application for such a scholarship?
I had a friend who was actually from the village who was a man, and he actually helped me get a form, and he never thought I would come because, one, I was already engaged, and a husband was already waiting. But because I went to him and I said, I want to go to where you are, And he said, okay, are you serious? I said, yes. And so he gave me the forms. I applied to the only one university. I got accepted. And the thing was to raise money to come here.
Of course.
And also to encourage, because I didn't want to leave to despise my elders. I didn't want just to run away and come here. I wanted them to support me because over time they have supported the men to go away. They've always raised money for boys to go to school. So I wanted them to raise money for a girl to go to school. And so I managed to talk to them. I went to the elder who is like a chief of the village, and very early in the morning before the sunrise, so that the first thing is in the morning it's me, and we believe that morning brings good news. So I was bringing good news to him that he was going to support me to come here. And so we rallied the village. We rallied. To me, what was so significant on that time was to get the mothers to be involved in sending their own daughters. Mm. And I would sit down and listen to them. And I said, you know, if you can support me to go to school, I will come back and help you. And I will write down, they will talk about maternity clinic, they will talk about schools, they will talk about many things that they wanted in their own community.
Natalia, and we will talk further and take your calls when we come back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Vital Projects Fund, supporting the Museum of Modern Art, now presenting a retrospective of Willem de Kooning. More at MoMA.org. From John and Catherine Debs, committed to advancing public understanding of America's energy needs and options. And by the Overbrook Foundation, supporting catalogchoice.org, a nonprofit service that allows customers to decide which catalogs to receive in the mail. This is NPR.
In the new book, Confidence Men, Wall Street, Washington, and the Education of a President, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ron Suskind describes rivalries and dysfunction in the Obama White House early in Obama's term. Now some of the people quoted in the book are saying they were misquoted or their comments were taken out of context. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Ron Suskind. Join us.
We're talking about the opportunities and the challenges facing women worldwide, and a new report from the World Bank talking about the global advantages of gender equality. We are a long way from that around the world, and even here in the U.S., going back to the defeat of the Equal Rights Amendment, which never happened. Here in the studio, Kakenya Nataya of the Kakenya Center for Excellence and Ritu Sharma of Women Thrive Worldwide. Ritu, tell me about your organization and what you have been doing.
Well, what we are here to do is to represent in the United States in front of the U.S. Congress, the White House, the State Department, the voices of many, many, many women like Kakenya and women who have not been able to come to this country and to bring the reality of their lives to the decision makers here in Washington who right now are looking at massive budget cuts to aid that will really impact women and girls around the world. Our job is to represent those voices and make sure that they get a fair hearing here in the nation's capital.
And Kakenya, tell me about the Kakenya Center for Excellence.
Kakenya Center for Excellence is a school for girls, 8-year-olds to 14 years old, based in my own community. It's a school we started, and our aim is really to empower the girls, to tell them that they can reach this, you know, there are no limits to what they can achieve. We talk to them about, we teach them about what female genital cutting is. We teach them their rights, that they have the right to go to school. We teach them that, you know, they don't have to be married when they're young. And so for really for them to achieve their dreams.
And how are the village elders behaving now?
They're very supportive. They didn't like the idea when we were starting. But now that the girls are in the school, the girls are speaking up instead of speaking, you know, looking down. Everybody wants to be part of a success. And so they are very supportive of what we are doing. And
how large is your village?
I think you would consider it as a town. It's about 10,000 people. It's still... But, you know, we started the school 2 years ago, and now we have 94 girls. And each year we add 30 girls into the school and empower them.
And how is it being paid for?
Most of the girls, it's a combination of many, 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 many routes and many, many supporters. I have been fortunate that to have very, very many people support the girls through scholarships and through, you know, supporting a girl at the school.
And who is doing the teaching?
We have teachers from the local community and with around Kenya who are teaching the girls. And the mothers also, the fathers also support the girls. They, you know, provide food for the girls. So it's a combination of many, many people.
So back to your story. After you came here, you went to college 4 years and then went on to graduate school as well?
Yes, I'm actually right now just about to finish my doctorate from the University of Pittsburgh and going back to Kenya in November. To really do work on the ground.
Will you stay there?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. I think that it's been very challenging working from a distance. And to me, what really motivates me, what makes me so excited is to see those young girls so happy and smiling and, you know, just they have so much hopes, and I just want to be there because they inspire me. And there's so much I can do in my own country and also throughout Africa. And I think being in Kenya would be the right place to be.
Is there continuing genital mutilation there in your village?
Unfortunately, some of them are still there. But one thing that I have to tell you that all the girls that are coming to our school, their parents have signed an agreement that they will never cut their daughters. And this is just, you know, amazing. So I'm sure that our goal is that we want to eradicate FGM in the next, you know, 5 to 10 years in my own village.
You have done extraordinary work.
Yes.
How do your village elders think of you now?
They all take pride of my success, obviously, because they did bless me to come to this country. And they all want their daughters to be like me because I have become a role model. And that I always speak of it's very important to have role models because in my village, we didn't have any other person. But now they have me and they look at me and they say, she has made it. And so I want my daughter to be like her.
And for you, as you talk about and hear Kakenya Ritu, how many other women can you reach?
I think that the only way the world is really going to change is the way that Kakenya is changing it. We've had the economic evidence that's in this World Bank report for many, many years. It's useful, but it's not what changes the minds of men or elders or communities. What changes people is being faced by a girl who is saying, it's my right to go to school. It's my right to live. That's what really changes communities from the ground up. I think the best thing the World Bank could do is to invest in women like Kakenya. There are so many women who are doing extraordinary things in their communities. Incredible, starting businesses with $50. Women who are building shelters for women in Afghanistan, a dangerous place in the world.
So you're saying simply recognizing the inequality is just doing one step.
To see it is to take the first step. To support those who are putting their lives on the line to change it is the next best step that you can take.
And you, Kakenya, what is your view when you hear talk about gender inequality in terms of money? Is that the answer?
I think you can put money in a woman's hand, but when she's so afraid that her husband is going to beat her, it's not going to help her. But if she knows her rights, if she's educated, and that's why I believe in education so much, if she's educated about her rights, she's able to go to the police. She's able to say, I have the right. She's able to speak up. And one thing that, and that's what I do in the school, is that we want to teach the girls they need to speak up, because it's one thing for us to do for them. But if they speak up, that is a whole different thing, because now they are the ones who are taking the lead.
But you had your mother's support. How many girls in that village will have their mother's support to do as you did?
I think always mothers always want the best for their daughters, and that what we know from my experience is that, you know, when we teach the mothers about the approach is not just teaching the girls, it's teaching the mothers, it's teaching the fathers, it's bringing the entire community together, because you can't do just by girls alone, but you have to bring the fathers in there. And mothers, as Mr. Selick was saying, that if you invest in a woman, she is going to invest in her daughters. She's going to invest in her boys. She's going to bring up a family. But when you educate or you invest in a boy, it's just going to be just one person or one family, or that's it. It doesn't have a ripple effect as when you educate
Interesting.
A woman.
All right, let's open the phones first to Katie in Greenville, North Carolina. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I have to say, I just absolutely got goosebumps from this last section. Thank you so much. I just wanted to mention another story of a woman that I heard about, Wangari Maathai, who is quite well known as I understand it, and her tree planting movement. And I recognize that there is so much value in all the small stories, as we were just discussing. But this movement, as far as the environmental impact that's possible, that can be concurrent with the empowerment of women, and how well those two things went together in Wangari Maathai's tree planting movement. And I just wanted to bring that up as a really another incredibly inspirational story. And thank you so much. I'll take my response off the air.
Thank you, Katie.
Wangari Maathai is another just incredible, remarkable woman in Kakenya sitting next to me with a big smile on her face. I think we both just have incredible admiration.
Tell me
for
about her.
Wangari Maathai is a woman who began the Green Belt movement in Kenya. What she saw happening was that trees were being cut down, stolen for logging, and she brought the community together, the women, to plant trees and reforest, stabilize the community, stabilize the soil. And what she did that is so inspired, and I'll never forget her saying this to me, is that you need the men too. The women can grow seedlings in the nursery, and they are so tender and so caring of the trees, but nobody can dig a hole like a man. And we need both. We need both. Her story is that she spent many years in jail. She was prosecuted by the government, and then she won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2004.
I wonder if you, Kakenya, believe that this report from the World Bank can change minds, can change attitudes within villages like yours about the need for an equality between the men and the women. As Sharma has just said, it's clearly important to have both, but to treat them equally.
Exactly. And I think that the report is so influential in the government of Kenya, which can take the step of, you know, distributing and actually doing the work that is written on the report. And so it's one step that the World Bank has recognized about it, and then putting pressure on countries, and which I think that the bottom line is that who is that who is going to be on the ground actually implementing and actually doing the work. So it is one step, but we still have a long way to go.
What is, from your perspective, what do you see as the biggest challenge to gender equality?
I think the biggest challenge for me is that there is this ignorant mind that men do realize that women are very important in bringing change in their community. But there's that power dynamic that it's an ignorant mind that it takes some strong will people to step
exactly.
up and say no, because it's not that people didn't know that FGM is against the law. They know it, but they don't want to practice. They still want to oppress the women. They still want to see them as, you know, second class citizens. They still want to see them down. But it's that will, that one person who can stand up and say no. And that I'm looking forward for that one man or two men in my village who will say that.
Do you believe you'll find them?
Yes, I do. I have them.
She'll marry one of them.
She'll marry one of them.
No doubt.
No doubt. But as you look at the statistic that Mr. Zelik and I talked about, the almost 4 million women who go missing each year, some of these because of infanticide, some selective abortion. How much has each of you seen of this happening, Ritu?
Oh, I've seen it profoundly and with my own eyes in villages where the baby boys are fat and chubby and adorable, and the girls are thin as rails, and it's heartbreaking. As a mother, it's unspeakable, and you see it. It is everywhere. It's part of the fabric. It's part of the psyche of lives. And I very much agree with Kakenya that it's not just about changing economics or making an economic case for change. It is about winning hearts and minds. Mm. It is about opening the minds of fathers so that they see their daughters as full human beings and love them
Kakenya,
as much as their
you
boys.
You have how many siblings? Seven?
Yes.
And are they boys, girls?
We have two boys, and the rest are girls.
The rest are girls.
Yes.
Are they in school?
Yeah, everybody in my family in school.
And it's all because of you?
I believe so, but also my mom. My mom is a very strong woman. She's undergone so much that she makes us go to school, whether we like it or not.
And so, the boys?
Yes, both boys and girls.
So how do you see your future?
Oh, wow. I really want to work to better my community, my country, and my world. And to me, that means I want to work to make sure that, you know, girls, boys, you know, all children are seen equally and not as based on gender, but be a child is a child and they have rights and they are protected, and the same thing to women.
Natalia of the Kakenya Center for Excellence, Ritu Sharma of Women Thrive Worldwide. Thank you both so much for joining me.
Thank you so much,
Dan. It's great to be here.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Sarah Ashworth, Lisa Dunn, and Nikki Jex. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.